Hello, welcome to another episode of Inspiration from Zion. I'm Jonathan Feldstein, and I have the privilege of being your host, coming to you from the Judean Mountains here in Israel. I like to refer to it as the original Bible Belt. Inspiration from Zion is a program of the Genesis 123 Foundation, whose mission is to build bridges between Jews and Christians, and Christians with Israel in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. I pray that you will find this, all of those. Through this program, we're excited to connect you to people and stories in and relating to Israel to give you a window to look through, experiencing aspects of life here that you might not otherwise know about. We want this to be interactive, so please be in touch with us at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com and send along any questions and any comments about any topic anytime. Or you can reach us at genesis123.co or follow and like Inspiration from Zion on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay tuned until the end, where we're also going to share an exciting opportunity, and please feel free to share this with others who will also find it of interest. Today's a conversation that I've been looking forward to having for quite some time. Shabbos Kestenbaum found himself in the middle of a tremendous anti-Semitic barrage of attacks on Harvard University as he was finishing his graduate degree this past academic year. Now that we're well entrenched in the beginning of the new academic year for 2024-25, the hate, the anti-Semitism, and of course the anti-Israel protests and pro-Hamas, pro-terrorist protests are continuing. I'm excited to introduce Shabbos because he's a very wise, sound voice for a reason, and he's also taken something to Harvard University that he never expected by actually initiating a lawsuit. Please join me as we have this amazing conversation together.
I'm especially excited to have a guest today who I've been dying to meet literally for months. And this conversation, indicative of my schedule and his schedule, has taken a little time to coordinate. But here we are. Shabbos Kestenbaum is so prolific. I like to be alive in 50 years to see where his life and career go. What's interesting is that anyone on social media knows that they get bombarded with many, many comments and posts from people all over the place. And I see his things a lot. But much more significant about his posts, which I typically find really insightful, is what he's doing and what he's been doing. Shabbos graduated with his master's from Harvard University this past spring and has also, and I'm curious to the timeline, initiated a lawsuit against Harvard, which I saw a video that you did, and it was definitely not the position that you intended to be in, graduating and suing your alma mater at the same time. Shabbos, thank you for joining. I would love to know from you, before we even talk about the lawsuit and your observations of what's going on in America with anti-Semitism, specifically on the campuses, is what's your experience been and what ultimately provoked you to initiate this lawsuit?
Sure. So the lawsuit is not something that we filed because we wanted to do it. We filed it because we felt like we had to do it. Harvard has a strong track record of going out of its way to make sure minority groups feel included and welcomed and safe. And yet when it came to Jewish students, there seemed to have been a double standard. And I can really spend hours and hours going through a laundry list of incidents. We can talk about the Jewish student at Harvard who was spat on for wearing a kippah, the Jewish student who was physically assaulted at the business school, the Israeli student who was asked to leave class because her nationality made others uncomfortable, the staff member who challenged me to debate him as to whether Jews were behind 9/11. I mean, these are things that are so absurd and irrational, abnormal. You would think that an institution as prestigious and revered in the American imagination as Harvard University would have taken proactive steps. But on the contrary, they have normalized, accepted, and celebrated a culture of anti-Semitism. So after October 7th, we tried working with the administration. We tried to get the implementation of policies, or at least the enforcement of policies. And Harvard was either unable or clearly at this point unwilling to do anything about it. So the lawsuit was really our last tool in the toolbox, our only recourse for justice, equity, and fairness. And it's a damning indictment on the state of higher education, and certainly a damning indictment on Jewish involvement at Harvard University that in order to receive that equity, we have to resort to litigation. We have to resort to a court of law.
So thank you for that. You got a master's from Harvard and an undergraduate from where?
From Queens College.
From Queens College. You're young, but you're worldly and very sophisticated. Have you ever seen any kind of behavior toward any other religious, ethnic, or minority group that's been tolerated on American campuses broadly, Harvard specifically, or in general?
Thankfully not. In the 21st century especially, universities, rightly or wrongly, are particularly, or I would even say overtly, cautious and sensitive towards minority students, really all students, broadly speaking, which makes the current predicament that Jewish students, not just at Harvard, but across American institutions of higher learning, it makes their position very odd and tedious and I would say dangerous, because this sort of seems like it's the only type of hatred, the only type of bigotry, the only form of discrimination that is tolerated. So, when I'm not doing Harvard, I actually studied the Holocaust. That's what I came here to do. I'm very interested in how theological groups came to rationalize or understand the Holocaust. And I'm
Wow.
obviously sensitive and cautious about Holocaust comparisons. I think they're way too liberally employed. At the same time, as someone who has a great aunt alive and well who remembers hiding during Kristallnacht while her father was being arrested, I do think a certain type of comparison is apropos, which is that Kristallnacht did not begin with burning books. Kristallnacht did not begin with smashed windows. It did not begin with mass deportations. It began with the acceptance, the normalization, and the celebration of categorizing the Jew as an other, as different. And I think that type of acceptance we're seeing across college campuses in America. We're seeing that across broad swaths of our society. And we Jewish people know what happens when that type of rhetoric and narrative goes unchecked, which makes this lawsuit, which makes our campaign, our movement, so critical for the future of American Jewry.
So I want to talk about the lawsuit, but I want to dig down a little bit deeper in terms of the Holocaust analogy. I agree with you. Holocaust analogies are overused, and it cheapens the Holocaust and the fact of the suffering, the fact of 6 million Jews being murdered, the purging of one third of the Jewish people. But so where is a red line vis-a-vis Holocaust analogies? It's very appropriate that you're talking about. And by the way, for people who don't know, who are following, Kristallnacht is the November 1938 purge against Jewish synagogues, Jewish businesses that took place throughout Germany in 1938. And I think without you even saying it, the piece that is also appropriate, not just that it happened and was unsafe and made Jews uncomfortable, but by and large, the world did not respond. Where's a red line where you can draw that, no, this Holocaust analogy is not appropriate when people are calling it a Holocaust?
Sure, it's an interesting question and one that is it's difficult to define, especially when dealing with hypotheticals, but let's look at the facts on the ground, for example. So before Kristallnacht, you had the Nuremberg Laws, of course. The Nuremberg Laws were instituted in 1935, and that was a codified legal system of discrimination. So Jews can't appear on public benches. They can't be buried in a non-Jewish cemetery. There can't be interracial or interreligious relations. It would be just simply factually inaccurate to state that the experience of American Jews is completely analogous to the experience of German Jews in the 1930s, because find me a law, find me a policy that on the books discriminates against Jewish people for the sole sake of being Jewish. I mean, you can't really find a law that in any way compares to the legalized system of anti-Semitism. I mean, what gets lost in Holocaust education and Holocaust memorialization, I should say, is not simply that there was a genocide, but that this was meticulously planned, that this went through the democratic process, that Adolf Hitler was the democratically elected chancellor of Germany. Our lawsuit only has teeth because of legal protections because of Title
Excellent.
VI of the Civil Rights Act. And Title
Excellent.
VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 clearly articulates that discrimination is not only wrong morally, but it's illegal. It's not something that is allowed. So I think people, as you said, are very liberal in their deployments of these comparisons. But again, it would simply be inaccurate to state that what we're going through is entirely reminiscent because it really isn't.
Right.
Now, should we be so naive as to suggest that therefore it can never happen again? Of course not. And it could happen again, which is why we have to be vigilant, which is why we have to be on top of our game, so to say, which is why organizations like the ADL, the AJC, the Simon Wiesenthal Center are so crucial in this fight. But at the same time, there are market differences.
So the excellent point. If you had been a student in Germany in 1938 and tried to sue anyone, at best, you would have been laughed at. You might have been disappeared or shot in the street.
Right. I mean, at its core, they made Jews legally different from non-Jews, and you can't point to an analogous
Right.
policy in the United States today.
Okay. Thank God. What's the nature of the lawsuit? And what did what you kind of showed your hand a little bit, but I'm curious, what did you try to do to avoid actually having to do a lawsuit?
Sure. So let me just back up for a second. So according to the Office of Civil Rights, which is a department within or a division within the Department of Education. Religious discrimination is legal under Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act based on a couple of different criteria. And one of them is national origin. And what the Trump administration did is sort of reclassify Jews under law were no longer simply a religion because Judaism isn't just a religion, but it's also an ethnicity. And because we now have the legal distinction of being an ethnicity, we now have a legal claim under Title VI saying, well, hang on, if national origin is a protected class, then we are a protected class. So that's sort of the legal merits to how we were able to file a lawsuit. We have some other provisions such as breach of contract, but they're not as relevant for this discussion. In terms of what we did practically at Harvard to sort of mitigate the really precarious and dangerous situation that Jewish students were experiencing, is I, in a personal capacity, was reaching out to the then president of Harvard, Claudine Gay, to the provost, future president of Harvard, Alan Garber, to my own dean, Marla Frederick. To the offices of diversity, equity, and inclusion, really trying to explain what Jewish students were experiencing, what I was experiencing, and really just either being rebuffed or ignored. And to this day, Alan Garber or Claudine Gay, they never once responded to an email of mine. Marla Frederick,
Okay.
never responded to me. And this is well before we even filed the lawsuit. So some defendants will say, oh, well, now it's complicated because there's active litigation, which number one, I don't buy because you still have an obligation to your students, lawsuit or not. And number two, we filed the lawsuit in mid-January. So you had all of October, all of November, all of December, most of January. And there was nothing. Not only was there nothing, but the situation just simply spiraled out of control.
Got worse.
Got worse, yeah.
And this was how long after Claudine Gay's no, notorious appearance in Congress?
Yeah, so she testified on December 5th, and as I said, we filed mid-January, I think the 19th maybe. And it's funny, I always say that Claudine Gay inadvertently became the best advocate for her for the Jewish community at Harvard on that day, because I at least had been saying in a personal capacity that we are treated qualitatively different than other minority groups simply because we're Jewish. And I was either ignored or told I was being overtly sensitive or exaggerating. And then all of a sudden you have the president of the university under oath in live TV in front of Congress state actually that you could call for the genocide of Jewish people depending on the context. And I remember,
Understood.
pointing to the TV and saying, aha, you see, I told you. So through her own sheer stupidity, she became really an ardent defender of our cause.
Indeed. Shabbos, let's take a real quick break. This is so fascinating. I want to talk more about the lawsuit, but let's take a real quick break.
As remarkable and miraculous as Israel is, and its very existence a testimony to God's faithfulness, in many ways, Israel's like most other countries. Just as there are parents anywhere who have stronger and weaker parenting abilities, and adults become a product of situations in their lives that they cannot control, making their ability to raise and care for their own children even harder, that's true in Israel as well. The Genesis 123 Foundation is committed and takes the mandate seriously to care for the least of these, our brothers, our children. We're committed to bless and strengthen orphans and at-risk youth, to invest in them, to empower them, so that their future will be brighter than their past or their present. But Israel is unique in that there are always threats of war and terror which know no bounds. For children who come from homes that are not safe, sometimes the very scary reality of living in a community that's not safe is too much to bear. We are committed to turning orphans and at-risk youth into children of promise. We fund a variety of programs to help those most in need as widely as we can. We invite and encourage you to join us today so that we can ensure their brighter tomorrow. Please visit genesis123.co to find out more and to send your love and most generous donation today.
Okay, so amazing that she's actually, without you using the word, essentially one of your own witnesses for your lawsuit. What's the nature of the lawsuit? What are you suing Harvard about, and what are the damages, and what are you expecting?
Sure. So the biggest component is the aforementioned Title VI, which I explained earlier, and the other is breach of contract. So when I give Harvard my tuition dollars, I expect sort of two things. One is a safe learning environment, and the other is a learning environment. And number one, it's the case that it has not been safe. And number two, we've had diminished educational opportunities. When your library is surrounded by masked Kafia Dawn protesters, both on campus and from around the community, who've made it on their way to campus, and they're chanting "Globalize the Intifada," well, now you're not able to learn in the library anymore. So that's just, you know, it's a silly example, but it's a concrete, practical example of how this became routine for me and my experiences as a student at Harvard. So the damages we're seeking range from very practical and very reasonable. So things like tuition reimbursements, punitive damages, an articulation of the policies they will enforce, a third-party monitor to make sure Harvard's in compliance with their obligations under law, mandatory Title IX training for anti-Semitism in the same way there already is for other forms of hatred and discrimination. And again, I would like to add that these things Harvard should have already done.
Yes.
It's sad, and it's pathetic, and it's frustrating that they will only do this so long as a judge forces them to do it. I think that's quite telling. But then we have some other asks. And again, Harvard should do this on their own merits, but obviously they won't. And that is the rescinding of the hundreds of millions of dollars they receive annually from anti-democratic, anti-Western, anti-Semitic countries, Russia, China, Qatar, Saudi Arabia. We want there to be disclosure. Where is this money coming from? What are you doing with that money? What is the stipulation for said monies? You know, I always say that we're sort of fighting two fronts. One is the court of law, and the other is the court of public opinion. And I would say we're quite successful in both fronts, but certainly the court of public opinion. And in a personal capacity, I try to work with lawmakers on both sides of the aisle so that things like Harvard's tax-exempt status or the hundreds of millions of dollars in federal subsidies given to Harvard and other Ivy League universities that are also violating federal law simultaneously, it should not be a right. This is not enshrined in the Constitution. This is privileged. And so long as Harvard and colleges act in bad faith and violate federal statutes, they should not be entitled to federal privileges. So that's separate from the court case, of course, but it's something something that I'm no less passionate about.
And it's interesting because really, as you said, everything you're saying isn't really rocket science. These are things that it wouldn't take a Harvard student, much less the administration and board, to kind of figure out on their own that they have a problem, and they could come up with 10 easy fixes, so to speak, 10 things that could be done. And most of what you're saying, if not all of it, plus maybe a few other things, would be on that list. I want to talk about other universities, but I read this week that, I'm not sure the context, maybe you can help, that Harvard has announced greater kosher food options. That's lovely. When I was a student at Emory, they instituted a meal plan, and I went to the dean and I said, if you are going to require all students to pay for meals, you have to have meals that all students can eat. And Emory adopted a kosher deli, which I then became manager of, which was fun for a while. But it's nice to have more kosher food options, but does that have any bearing in terms of the safety and quality of life of Jewish students at Harvard?
Yeah. So I think there are two things at play. One, I'm obviously a critic of the university, but credit where credit is due. It's good. I you know, kosher food, expanding access to kosher food is a good thing. But two things to point out. Number one, this has been an issue for 25 years. And in fact, the incoming executive director of Harvard Hillel, Rabbi Jason Rubinstein, he relates publicly that he was fighting for this when he was a student. You know, students had been fighting for kosher food for 25 years. And it took the largest massacre of Jews since the Holocaust for Harvard to acquiesce. So I sort of joked on social media. I said, if Hezbollah invades, maybe they'll stop scheduling exams on the Jewish holidays. So look, it's good. Yeah. You know, this is a good thing. There was kosher dinner as part of the Harvard Hillel meal plan, but there was never any lunch. And you know, many students skipped out on that, which is just means that they're treated differently because of their religious practices. So it's a good thing. But again, number one, we have to ironically look at the context of it, the fact that it took so long for this to happen. But number two, to really answer your question, no, it doesn't really have any bearing on the fundamental issues at play here. And in fact, the Anti-Semitism Task Force, which is really a second iteration of a previously failed So they came up with their preliminary recommendations in June, and they said the only actually new concrete policy they came up with was they said pork products in the cafeteria should be labeled as such, which number one is just shockingly stupid, but number two totally misrepresents or certainly doesn't show any awareness of the Jewish community, because if you're keeping kosher, you're not eating in the cafeteria anyways. You could only eat at the Hillel. So this really does not come to address the fundamental issues at play here. And it becomes increasingly obvious that the only way we will address the fundamental issues is through litigation.
And that had nothing to do with your lawsuit, the kosher food, but you're saying that the rabbi, as a student himself, has been fighting for this for 25 years.
Yeah, people had been fighting this for years. I mean, I remember as a student well before October 7th mentioning this to Harvard Divinity School, saying, if you're a school of theology, and the whole point is that you study religion, why is there no kosher access in the cafeteria? Yeah. And again, even Harvard's new policy, it's only for undergrads. This does not affect grad students.
Oh,
right?
Interesting.
So, you know, there's still an uphill battle, but I want to give credit where credit is due. And this is a good first step.
Okay, good. Yeah, and you wrote a really nice article, not relating to this, but in Tablet, that I'm going to put as part of the notes for this program. I'm just curious, as a result of you filing a suit against Harvard, have there been other student-initiated lawsuits against other universities for similar?
Yeah, of course. So I'm actually part of a WhatsApp group of Jewish students across the country who the only thing we share in common is we're filing lawsuits against our university. So number one, my legal representation is Casswoods Benson Torres. They're an aggressive litigation firm based in New York City, and they're representing students at three other schools, at NYU, at Columbia, and at the University of Pennsylvania. And they're great, number one. But the suit at NYU was filed relatively quickly. I mean, before our suit.
Oh, okay. So
there already was this effort to engage in litigation. There have been dozens of similarly filed lawsuits across the country. You know, Colorado State just got one yesterday. UCLA had one last week. Cooper Union. There's a tremendous surge in this type of litigation simply because of what I mentioned earlier. Title VI of the Civil Rights Act now really does include religious discrimination and in particular anti-Semitism. So we really do have legal backing in a way that we sort of didn't before. But yes, yeah, students are, it's quite encouraging. Students are rising up and they're demanding their civil rights. And I support them wholeheartedly. And I think they are leading this effort on behalf of American Jewry, and we should support and amplify and encourage them as much as we can.
The word encourage is I want to pick up on you, because I've heard, it's a long time since I was on a campus and I don't live in America, but I'm curious, the sense is that many Jews on campuses have to kind of hide their identity and don't want to rock the boat. By all of these lawsuits taking place, are Jewish students generally perhaps feeling more emboldened or less afraid that they have to hide who they are?
So yes and no. One of the criticisms I often get is people unfairly say that I'm the self-appointed spokesman of the Jewish community at Harvard, which of course isn't true, and I've never said that. So I don't want to cast too broad of a brush here. What I do want to say is it's complicated. You know, I know, I can speak anecdotally. I know of students who don't wear kippahs anymore, not just at Harvard, but across college campuses. I know students who don't wear kippahs anymore. I know students who you know, don't wear the hostage yeah. dog tag anymore.
Or a bracelet like I have.
Or the bracelet, or they've ceased their involvement in Jewish communal life. There was just a study, I think it was by the Brandeis Center, published yesterday that found that about a third of Jewish students are apprehensive about expressing their Jewish identity publicly. So there is fear, there is trepidation. At the same time, and again, I'm speaking anecdotally, I have noticed that within my friend group, there are many people who are putting on the kippah for the first time. There are many people who are going to Harvard Chabad for the first time. In fact, I would actually argue we have record numbers.
Wow.
It's based on what our Friday nights look like pre-October 7th and now post-October 7th. So it's a mixed bag. There are certainly students who are rightfully apprehensive, and there are certainly students who are rightfully more determined and more proud than ever before to express their Jewish identity and their Jewish pride.
Yeah. It's remarkable talking with you, and underscores the platitude that, admit, I said, but not from a point of making a platitude, of really wishing I could be alive in 50 years to see where you and your career and life go. But one of the interesting things, one of the fascinating things where you really went high up on my radar was, as a registered Democrat, you not only attended the Republican National Convention, but spoke there. And you also recently attended the DNC, Democratic National Convention. I'm curious, I want to talk about the comparison. I don't know how political you're comfortable getting, but we'll go as far as you are. What brought it about that you, as a card-carrying Democrat, were invited to speak at the Republican National Convention?
Sure. So I think it's important, again, to use a dirty word, to contextualize what I was doing there and what I was saying. So right after my speech, as I'm leaving the stage, Omer Nutra's parents are walking on the stage. Omer Nutra, of course, is the American Jewish hostage being held in Gaza. So I was there to amplify a critically important message, that of campus anti-Semitism, that of left-wing anti-Semitism. And, you know, I said on Fox News the day after my speech, if the Democratic Convention wants me to speak, I'd be honored to do so.
Yes.
Happily do it. Unfortunately, they weren't interested in having me or any Jewish student speak, which is problematic. But I was there to show that if you're given a platform to speak in front of millions of people and you can proudly wear your kippah, I would be stupid not to do it. It would be a profound wasted opportunity. So of course I did it. And I would do it again in a heartbeat. And as I said, it's very worrying that the Democratic Convention not only did not have a speaker like that, but didn't address the issue in any meaningful way. What I will say is I tried for the last 10 months to either be nonpartisan or bipartisan, really working with Democrats and Republicans, and I will continue to do that. But, you know, just recently I wrote an op-ed, and I'll publish a more detailed one in the coming days about my endorsements. And I've endorsed President Trump. I think given the real precarious and existential issues that the state of Israel faces, that the American Jewish community faces, that our global standing in foreign policy faces, I think given his flaws and even given the significant policy disagreements I have with him, I think ultimately electoral politics are zero-sum games. They're binary choices. And of the two choices, I think he would be a better choice. So I've endorsed him, I think, just yesterday or 2 days ago in this op-ed. And I would encourage certainly young Jewish Americans to really reconsider their political allegiances. And I'm still a Democrat. I have not switched my party. I will gladly and happily vote for Democratic future nominees who are willing to return our party to our core, to restore the soul of the Democratic Party. I will continue to vote for progressive politicians like my Congressman Richie Torres, who's simply incredible, like my governor, Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul. I think they're excellent politicians and lawmakers. But in terms of the Democratic nominee for president, there's just simply no way I can, in good faith, vote for Kamala Harris.
Wow. Okay. So I love it if, first of all, if you would share the article so I can also share that with other people. Again, you have a very, very important voice. And amazing that you're still all of this as a Democrat, endorsing President Trump as a Democrat, and have a belief that the Democratic Party not just must, but can come back. What about Kamala Harris as the candidate worries you that forget about her and her positions, but that the party is going to continue to go in the wrong direction?
Well, I can answer the second part of the question first. Just look at quantities. So the squad was 4 members. Now it's 12. 5 years ago, about 10 Democratic lawmakers walked out on BB's speech. Last month, it was 110.
Correct.
So the anti-Israel faction is growing. I mean, that's just objectively true. I don't think you could really square that or make excuses for it. I mean, so that's just number one. I'm not speculating here. I'm just looking at the raw data. But in terms of the first part of your question, I do believe that there are enough Democrats in the party today that can reshape the party. If you look at the news of this morning, of course, the successful rescue operation of an Arab Muslim hostage in Rafah, Kamala Harris was very clear that Israel under no circumstances could go into Rafah. She said, quote, I studied the maps and there is simply no way you can move any Palestinian. And of course, the Israeli Defense Forces were able to successfully relocate 1.5 million Palestinians in just a span of a couple of weeks and then rescue hostages. So if Vice President Harris was President Harris at the time, and she said under no circumstances can Israel go into Rafah, unclear if Israel would listen. And if they did, Harris in that same interview refused to rule out consequences. I mean, that's her word, consequences.
Yes.
To Israel. So that's really concerning. She has no clear plan to bring the hostages home. She has no clear plan on, you know, restoring the Iranian nuclear deal. She's been really contradictory. No real plan on our standing in terms of foreign policy. No real clear plan on campus anti-Semitism. So I'm happy for her to make the case. I'm happy to be convinced otherwise, but she hasn't even said for a press conference.
That's very honest. That's excellent. You know, it's interesting when you talk about moving Gazans from place to place. Part of her acceptance speech last week was in where she spoke about Gaza. She spoke about the suffering and related the fact that people have had to move three, four times around. And I wrote after that's actually a sign of victory, because if we remember at the beginning of the war, Hamas in its still iron control of Gaza was preventing civilians from moving from place to place. So it was really quite a big deal. Let's wrap up. Let's take one more quick break. And I want to wrap up with just one kind of broad question about your experiences at the DNC versus RNC.
Friends, Israel's at war, and the war may get worse before it gets better, much worse. It's going to be a long war because the enemy is the epitome of evil. It's not just a matter of overcoming troops on a battlefield, but overcoming a theology, an ideology, an evil one. While the Genesis 123 Foundation has been overwhelmed with the support of so many donations to the Israel Emergency Campaign, there's so much more that needs to be done. We've invested your donations that we've received so far strategically to make the biggest impact possible, whether helping with soldiers and their equipment and personal needs, to providing civilian security for outlying border communities, to relocating and settling several families from near the Gaza war zone, launching the global petition drive to support Israel in the face of pressure for a ceasefire, and long-term needs for at-risk children, traumatized now more than ever before. Please take a moment to pause this conversation right now and go to love.genesis123.co and donate generously. We value your trust, and we will keep all donors informed about how and where your donations are being used to contribute to make the biggest impact possible. And when you use that link, love.genesis123.co, you can also send your prayers and words of encouragement to Israelis of all backgrounds, just sending your love, something that we need so desperately. Thank you, and God bless you and your loved ones.
Okay, Shabbos, I know time sensitivity for you. I could have this conversation go on forever, and I'm really grateful you attended both. If you pull out the fact that you spoke at the RNC, which is a unique privilege and responsibility at the same time, did you have a sense in one convention versus the other, being what it was like being accepted as an American Jew, how the tone was vis-a-vis Israel and issues relating to anti-Semitism in the U.S.?
Yeah. Look, we have to call a spade here. The speakers who were touted as being, you know, the Jewish speakers were Doug Emhoff, were Charles Schumer, and were Josh Shapiro. Doug Emhoff's Jewish connection was that his grandmother makes brisket on Passover. Chuck Schumer's Jewish connection was he pointed to a blue pin saying, "I stand up to anti-Semitism." Meanwhile, because of Chuck Schumer, the Bipartisan Anti-Semitism Awareness Act has not even been given a Senate floor vote. Wow. And Josh Shapiro talks about, you know, his Jewish identity being a cornerstone of who he is, when meanwhile he spent the last 4 weeks trying to do everything he could to rid himself of his Jewish identity to make pick his vice president. So I'm more interested in substance. I'm more interested in what are the policies you are going to implement? What is your vision for America? What is your plan for Jewish Americans? And I just didn't see that at the DNC, and I've yet to see that from the Democratic Party. Even when they brought in the hostage families, Rachel and John Goldberg Polin, which was a good thing. And again, credit where credit is deserved. That was a good thing to do. I was at both conventions. The reaction from the Democrats was respectful. There were certainly people standing, and there were certainly people chanting, "Bring them home." And I posted that on social media because I wanted people to see that.
Yes.
But it's night and day with the RNC. With the RNC, every single person stood up. Every single person chanted, "Bring them home." I mean, thunderous applause. It took me 2 hours to get back to my seat. Why? People were hugging me. People were telling me they're praying for the hostages. People were telling me they stand with the Jewish people. It was night and day.
Amazing. Shabbos, you know, I want to thank you again for making the time. Since October 7th, all but one of my podcasts have been war-related. And unfortunately, not that anti-Semitism is something that's new. It's not. It's just exploded around America on the campuses. You've experienced that. You've done something that is heroic in terms of standing up. And you may not think of yourself in that capacity. You're doing the right thing because you were brought up well, because you have a strong identity and a firm backbone. And I admire that. And I'm grateful for you taking time today for people to hear it's not a subset, a part of what's going on in the Jewish world post October 7th. And we don't yet know where it's going to go, which is why what you're doing is so significant. Last word, is there anything, either any parting message or where people can follow and be in touch with you should they want more information?
Sure. So people can certainly follow me on social media. My Instagram is my name, Shabbos Kest. My Twitter is Shabbos K, so not too hard. And then, you know, my parting message is always the same, which is we're in this together. So whatever people's talents or capacities are, they should contribute to this effort in any way. You know, it doesn't have to be a soldier in the Israeli Defense Forces. It doesn't have to be a student on a college campus. It could be whatever your talents are, whatever setting you find yourself in, contribute in some meaningful way. So thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. And we'll look forward to successful continued updates. Thanks so much.
Amen. Take care.
As we've always done, if you stay to the end, we want to give you a special opportunity. For years, we've now offered a special incentive from Jonathan's Bookshelf. All we ask that you do is go to the Inspiration from Zion social media and like and follow us. When you comment and share the link to this program there, we will select one winner at random. This month, as for the last year, we have been providing a tremendous copy of our new book, Israel the Miracle. It's a $75 value. All you need to do is comment or share and like the link to this program, and we'll pick one person at random and hopefully surprise you with a free copy. We're always grateful that this podcast is sponsored by our friends at the Willow Run Greenhouse in Culpeper, Virginia. If you're ever in the area, I want to pop in and thank them for making this program possible. I know that'll be appreciated. And also special thanks to the Coyne family as well for their meaningful sponsorship. Inspiration from Zion and all the Genesis 123 Foundation programs are made possible by donations. So please consider joining us to help continue the dialogue and to build bridges. This episode is sponsored in memory of the 6 Israeli hostages who were recently murdered by the Hamas terrorists, and in comfort for their families. If you'd like to sponsor a future episode or honor a memory of a loved one for a special occasion, please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your comments as part of a dialogue and invite you to send questions as well, especially about traditional Judaism or our Ask the Rabbi programs. Wherever you are in the world, I pray that you and your loved ones are all safe and healthy, and send my blessings from right here in the Judean Mountains. God bless you.
Hallelujah. Al-Masha'ayah.